Listen to shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Shoot the Defence, brought to you by FNX and The Life of A. I'm your host, Del, and I'm joined by Asian football and Russian football expert Martin Lowe to talk about the World Cup. Martin, welcome to Shoot the Defence, mate. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Del?
Yeah, all good, all good. Are you looking forward to this competition?
I'm looking forward to it. I've been an Asian football follower. It might not last too long, but looking forward to it, apart from the VAR, of course.
Oh, of course, of course. I can understand that. I can understand, mate. Well, look, let's talk about the host nation, Russia, because we've heard so many negative things about the nation. You know, we've heard about the doping, we've heard about the safety, hooliganism, so much negativity surrounding Russia. What is the state of the national team at the moment?
Well, firstly, I think anybody that does travel to Russia will be pleasantly surprised. I think it's a lot of mass hysteria with an agenda-driven thing behind the media, but I'll kind of gloss over that and talk about the football itself, which is probably worse than the actual reputation. Russia are in a kind of a bit of a mess at the moment. Obviously, it's been 7 years since they won hosting rights, so it's not that it's crept up on them. But year on year, it gets worse and worse. 2 years since they collapsed so badly at the Euros, Stan Shcherbakov has taken charge of the national team, and it's just been appalling, effectively. For a host team that plays, obviously, all their friendlies in the last couple of years, he's got a 25% win percentage. Terrible, really, for any kind of lower to middle ranking side, let alone a side ready to host a World Cup. Multiple injuries have hit them bad, but also the lack of quality players is hamstringing the team. Apart from having a relatively simple group, I think it's going to be quite a tough watch, really, for any Russian fans.
Well, you mentioned the head coach, Shcherbakov. I know he had four spells as a player at Sparta and Moscow. He represented the national team when they were USSR and the Commonwealth of Independent States. I believe that's what they were called back then. And Russia. He raised a few eyebrows after dropping Shcherbakov. Now, why in the world would Sparta and Moscow's ice hockey coach say that he hopes Shcherbakov stays calm throughout the competition?
About how he stays calm, sorry. Yeah, I think he's quite erratic in his changes, so there's not much method to his madness, I would say. He's changed the whole formation, the whole idea of the national team. He's gone back to more of a in vogue three at the back with wing backs, which doesn't necessarily fit for the national team personnel. However, it started to bear fruit in the last year with a couple of decent results. This has completely changed in the last week, where he's gone back to a back four. They continue to start losing games, and it's really kind of, you can't guess where he's going to go next. You can point to the fact that he hasn't got the squad available and he's trying to make things better, but more the fact he's not necessarily a safe pick to kind of cruise through this group and try and get second. It's more going to be a do or die situation.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier that they're not producing, well, they don't have a great squad. Well, why do you think they're not producing great players? Because I remember when I was growing up, I remember players like Valery Karpin. I remember Alexei Smertin that played in the Premier League, Viktor Onopko, who else? Alexander Mostovoy. Why aren't Russia producing these players? I mean, it's a massive, massive country.
I completely understand that it's a grievance of Russian football fans everywhere, really. Obviously, it's 20 years since 2008, where they got to the Euro semi-finals with Arshavin, Pavlyuchenko, and the rest, really. And they're still kind of relying heavily on a couple of those players. Sergei Ignatievich has just come back after retirement at 38.
Wow.
Just because of the lack of players, and he will be their starting centre-back. The reason, and the main reason, if you speak to anybody really regarding Russian football, apart from the RFU that think it's a good idea, is the foreign player limit. So there's a limit in Russia which is quite unique to Russia in European football. The fact that you're only allowed to play a certain amount of players, foreign players in a match, have a certain amount of players in a squad. When you consider that, obviously, Zenit, CSKA Moscow, and the bigger teams have got quite a hefty budget, and obviously are competing on the European stage, the demand goes up for domestic players. Their wages go a lot higher than they would get abroad, hence they're not going to leave, hence the quality doesn't go up. So you get a lot of players. I think the star in the making, obviously, is, or he should have been in a long point, would be Alexander Kokorin, who's been long linked with moves, glamour moves, to kind of Arsenal or to a big side in Germany. He's just had no need to go abroad. So he's getting to a stage where he's kind of mid-20s, he's stagnated, he stayed at Zenit, he's going to always be in Russia for the rest of his career. There's no progression on there, and you can see that with a lot of the players. You can see how bad it's really getting, that for the first time in a long history, you see a nationalisation of players. So you've seen Galerma, the goalkeeper from Lokomotiv Moscow. He hasn't made the squad this time, but he made the squad in at the Euros. Obviously, he's Brazilian born, and only been over here through playing for Lokomotiv Moscow. The same is for Mario Fernandez, who will be a starting right back for Russia. Brazilian born, probably could have got into the Brazilian national team squad, but it's the money on offer that Russia has is keeping the players at home. But unfortunately, the Russian Premier League isn't to the same standard as the Premier League, La Liga. As you say, those players, the great players of the past, went out and tried themselves on these stages.
Well, do you know what? You've led me to a good segue here, because you mentioned a lot of Russian players are staying in the nation because of the money. When I look at the players in the past, like, you know, off the top of my head, I'm thinking like maybe, I don't know, Dmitry Sichev. I think there was a youngster called Kursakov at one point, who was a forward. They had so much hype about him in 2002. A lot of these players didn't really go on to better themselves. Even the goalkeeper, Akin Fayev, was rated as potentially one of the best goalkeepers in the world, and he just seems to have regressed. Why do you think? Is it just money, or is it just difficult for these guys to leave, because obviously with agents and whatnot?
I think it is that aspect of it. I think it starts a chain reaction, and I might go on to kind of talk about Asian footballers, and it is an issue in the Middle East where you've got a lot of players that can earn quite a lot of high salaries for very little quality of football. So these players don't want to go and test themselves elsewhere, just for the fear of failure. Obviously, it's a catch-22 situation. You need to have a good World Cup, a good Euros to start attracting managers to come in for you, and obviously 2008 at the Euros did that, and that should have seen the quality of football increase, more players going abroad, which you got with Arshavin and Pavlyuchenko and so forth, but it just really hasn't kind of stuck with them. There's been numerous failures by the RFU and the managers of the national teams, which I think are holding them back. But there are, while this squad is quite a limited squad, there are a couple of players that are linked with European moves. So you hope that even if Russia don't do too well, the likes of Fedor Smolov, Alexander Golovin, they're both at Krasnodar and CSKA respectively, they are getting linked with high-profile European clubs. But you hope they'll take that risk and maybe get paid a bit less than they are at home. Otherwise, their careers are going to stagnate like the rest of their peers.
Well, if you're looking at this Russia squad at the moment, there's one player that stands out for me, because he seems to have had a better career than his twin, and that's Anton Miranchuk. What can you tell us about him? Because a lot of people are putting all their eggs in one basket when it comes to him. Is that right?
Well, Alexei is probably the better of the twin, probably will be in longer term. They are both relatively simple, similar in their positioning, and they're both they play just in behind, which will be the Fedor Smolov, and the most national team viewers will hope that both of the Miranchuks will start are both highly rated attacking midfielders, quite quite odd physiques for an attacking midfielder, so quite tall, but they have great feet and good at getting into the box late to finish off chances. You just hope that Shostov trusts in the talent that obviously is there and doesn't kind of fall back on the kind of the tried and trusted names.
Mm. Well, I've heard about Alexei being the golden boy of Russia. I know he made his debut at Lokomotiv when he was 17 under Slaven Bilic, and he made his national team debut at 19. Can you see any parallels between him and, say, I don't know, Arshavin? Is he going to be a player that you can effectively see leaving Russia to play in say, England or even Germany or Italy?
I think pure talent-wise, it's pretty difficult to match up to the likes of Arshavin. And I suppose it's because of Arshavin's size and physical attributes, he had to kind of make his way on talent alone, whereas Miranchuk is getting more of a physical build, so it would come back to, or kind of gel into a bigger league easier. But it comes, again, down to a mental state of whether they want to go, whether they can take the pressure of their clubs behind them. Of course, the Lokomotiv Moscow won the Russian Premier League this year, so we'll get to see him on the biggest stage in the Champions League this coming summer. So I wouldn't expect them to be leaving at this stage, but it would be a good demonstration of his abilities when the draw comes around.
Absolutely. Do you give them a chance of getting out of that group? Because, let's be honest, Uruguay will probably win it. Saudi Arabia, many people think they're going to be the whipping boys. We know Egypt are very compact. Hector Cooper's got them very well drilled. If Mo Salah is fit, then obviously a lot of pressure is going to be on him to deliver. So do you think that with, you know, the whole Salah impact, there's going to be less pressure on Russia? Is it because that their host nations, the nation actually expects more?
I think the nation is drawn down. I think they're very excited. The nation it's a big event for the world's eyes to be looking on to Russia. It's quite strange, actually, that there isn't as much pressure on the national team because of that. It's more of the staging of it. And I think the expectations are getting a bit more realistic. Preparation over the last couple of years, but even the last 7 years of preparation, the Euros haven't gone well. We've gone through a couple of managers that just haven't got the best out of the team. I think the pressure is relatively low. The only way they'll get out of the group is by deficiencies of their opponents, which I think is a damn indictment, really, of where we are. Egypt, we're just hoping that, obviously, Salah may miss a game, may miss two games. Egypt haven't looked too good in preparation. And then the first game against Saudi Arabia is going to be, I think, probably one of the worst opening matches of a tournament we've seen for a long time. So as long as one of those teams win in that game, I think whoever wins between Russia and Saudi Arabia will follow Uruguay through, if we're thinking that Salah will miss at least one game at the World Cup.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm looking at the previous World Cups and I'm trying to cast my mind back to as far as Italia 90, because that's the first one I remember actually sitting down to watch. I think apart from the United States in 94 and South Africa, no other host nation has actually fallen before the quarterfinals. So do you think Russia could be in the South Africa USA bracket, or do you think they can actually get past the quarterfinals?
Quarterfinals would be pushing it, assuming that the way that the draws happened, even if they come top of the group or second in the group, they will play. If you assume Spain and Portugal will progress from Group B, it's going to be a tough ask. And they've obviously played Portugal in the Confederations Cup last summer. They only got edged 1-0, but it was a gulfing class between them. I think it'll be a successful tournament if they get out of the group, to be all honesty. If they get I'm just looking for a win, to be honest, and that's how probably most Russian fans will be looking at it. In the last three tournaments they played, so 2012, 2014, 2016, they've only won one victory in those last three tournaments. That probably shows you kind of how far they've come back from kind of the dominance that they had 20, 30 years ago.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, let's talk quickly about South Korea, because they seem to be a nation in disarray. They struggled throughout the qualifiers. They seem very anemic in attack. Well, I mean, we know about Son Heung-min at Spurs and Ki Sung-hyun, but I know they sacked Uli Stielecker, and they brought in a fella, Shin Tae-yong, I believe. What can you tell us about him? Is he going to be pulling up any trees, or at least give him something to sing about?
It's reverting to type, really, at the moment. Last World Cup was a damn indictment from the whole of Asian football. There wasn't one win between them all at the tournament. In charge then, Hum Myung-bo, another former national team coach, was sacked immediately after it. It wasn't a big name. It was always going to likely happen. Uli Stielecker came in, forged an impressive defensive record, which made sure that they got through to the final of the Asian Cup that following January. But it only went so far throughout qualification. They were very, as you say, very feeble in attack, but very solid at the back. It's a very un-Korean way. The Koreans like fast, interactive football, attacking football, and looking for the victory, whereas it was safety first, but always under the German. Shin Tae-yong comes into it on a very similar record from Hum Myung-bo. He's a KFA man, so he's gone through the ranks, coaching at the Olympics, at the Under-20 World Cup. He's had mixed results. There have been some good results getting to the knockout stages of both the Olympics and the Under-20 World Cup against top-quality opposition. They topped a group with Germany and Mexico, two teams that are in their World Cup group at the moment at the Olympics, but then fallen a simpler hurdle. He's a bit of an unpredictable character, Shin. His press conferences are very misleading. He says, I'll never use 4-2-3-1. Categorical about that, and then we'll play that formation in the next match. I think he thinks he's clever than everybody else in Korean football, and he's often kind of brought up on this and questioned quite regularly. To be honest, I can't see him lasting past the World Cup. He was seen as a short-term fix to get them over the line in qualification. I think just the options out there at the moment, which is across Asia, there's been a lot of managerial changes. I just think he's going to see through the World Cup and probably meet his end afterwards, because obviously we've got an Asian Cup coming up in January, which is obviously going to be of great importance for everyone, considering they probably won't succeed at this World Cup.
I get you. Right, let's talk about Japan then, another nation that made the managerial change. I know Halihota was actually sacked in April. They brought in the technical director, Nishino. I don't really know too much about him. I can't even pronounce his name. That's how much I know about him. Yeah, thank you. I know that they drew against Haiti last October, which upset quite a few fans. We know about Kagawa Nakazaki and a few other players, but again, Japan, they're another nation that seems to be going in the World Cup with hardly any hopes or aspirations. I mean, I think their only hope is actually not to get hammered by Poland, Senegal and Colombia.
Yes, and that's another sad thing, really. I think it was all of a sudden hit hard last World Cup, where again they were playing Colombia in the World Cup. It just didn't go well last year, last World Cup. It was all added to be a promise for this upcoming World Cup with Vahid Halilhodžić in charge. He changed up the style of play. It was a bit more direct. It wasn't involving possession or interchanging of play in attacking areas. He ruthlessly got rid of the old guard, so you saw a couple of squads with Akatsuki Honda, Shinji Okazaki, Shinji Kagawa. They were all kind of cut from the national team picture, and it did provide results. It got them over the line. They finished top of the qualification group. The reason why he got sacked in the end was his personality. He was very hot-headed. He questioned the league, the fans, the players, anybody that you'd ask a question about, he would be questioning it. It's a very un-Japanese thing to be so damning on yourself, effectively, so self-deprecating. Akira Nishino comes in very similar to the Shin Tae-yong situation. He's a JFA man. he's a yes man. He's brought back Honda, Kagawa and Okazaki. People that label that as a bit misguided, and whether it's to do with sponsorships rather than the quality of football. But he's also promised to bring back the typical Japanese play, a bit more guile, a bit more possession rather than counter-attacking. But to be honest, the quality of the sides that they're going to be playing are going to be even much higher. So a counter-attacking play would probably suit this team a bit more than reverting to type, really. Nishino himself hasn't had much coaching experience in the last few years. He won the Asian Champions League back in 2008, but there hasn't been really any success outside of Japan. So it is a question mark against him. And we all forgive him that the fact that he's only come in since April. So at the moment, he's only had one match to play with. So it's an unknown package, but it is looking quite trap for Japanese fans.
It's sad, isn't it? Because I remember when the J-League was launched, there was so much hype about it. You know, they were talking about pumping money. I know Gary Lineker was there for a while. It's a shame, isn't it?
Obviously, with Iniesta going there this summer, there's rumours that Fernando Torres will join. Lucas Podolski is already there. There is a kind of a feeling that the J-League will kind of kick back into action. I think the J-League as an Asian league is up there for kind of quality to even compete with China, which apart from a couple of teams at the top, the domestic product is a lot better. I think it's the management of it. I think they've got the players and the quality of players to succeed. A lot of players who have made the move to Europe. It's just the JFA's handling of managers. This is their fourth manager in 4 years since the World Cup, so there's no sustained plan. I think that's the only kind of limiting factor for it is the disorganisation of some very good players.
Mm. And you use the word disorganised, and I think that's pretty fair to describe the Australian soccer team at the moment. I mean, look, we've got a lot of listeners in Australia, and they know how I feel about the national team at the moment. I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet because they didn't call up my friend Alex Gersbach. He's had a pretty decent season at Lons, to be fair. But Bert van Marwijk has come in. He's only in for this tournament, really. Graham Arnold's going to come in afterwards. Are we going to expect the 4-3-3?
He's known for being conservative, very conservative compared to obviously his predecessor Ange Postecoglou, who is what I'll admittedly say he's my favourite manager around at the moment. So I was gutted when he decided to walk away from the job after quite a lot of heavy criticism in the media and a lot of kind of scrutiny from above. But gets results, however, so something Postecoglou rarely did, really. There's a lot of style over substance. So Van Marwijk's return to basics. It's been a 4-3-3 formation, 4-2-3-1. The ideas of counter-attacking, it works with the quality of teams they'll be playing in at the World Cup. So when you're playing France, when you play even Denmark, those kind of quality teams, you're going to be on the back foot about everything. Obviously, Bert van Marwijk qualified with Saudi Arabia in Asian qualification, so he knows the Asian game, which was a miraculous turnaround to get Saudi Arabia to this World Cup. And that was played with some dire football, but they got over the winning post. I think Australia can go one of two ways, really. I think they've been in this Postecoglou mould for so long, and it's looked really impressive at times, but the results haven't come this way. Whether Van Marwijk's going to harness that or revert to type and play a bit defensively, a bit cautious, and just play the attacking kind of play on a whim. The players that have got, there's some real quality in there. Aaron Moy, obviously, is at Huddersfield in the Premiership. Tom Rogic just signed a 5-year contract at Celtic, which will put off suitors of going to the Premier League. They've got players there that can upset people on the day. It's just the approach and how the players adapt to that, which will be the key question.
Absolutely, absolutely. I know you've written a couple of articles on Saudi Arabia and Iran, two nations that will be try not to be the whipping boy, so to speak. In Saudi Arabia, they've got Juan Antonio Pizzi as the new head coach. Again, they've got Mohamed Al-Salawi, who scored 8 against East Timor, and I believe in a qualifier. I think in the qualifying campaign, it was under Van Marwijk, is that right?
Yes, Van Marwijk was the coach through qualification. He turned around a team to focus on defensive solidity, team unity, and play a Saudi Arabian style of football. Anybody that has ever kind of glimpsed at watching Saudi Arabian football, it's European football, but to the max, really. And there's a lot of diving going on. There's a lot of physical play. It's like every game's like an El Clasico in kind of. It's not good to watch, however, it's good to be harnessed within the national team. A bit like, I suppose, I'll make comparisons with Spain, not necessarily on the quality, but the fact that most of Spain's World Cup winning squad were hailed from Barcelona and Real Madrid, and that unity helped to kind of transition through. Of this squad, 20 of the 23 hail from three clubs in Saudi Arabia, so they've got a team unity there already. And that's what Van Marwijk tapped into. Since qualification, he was sacked only over his residential status. He refused to live in Saudi Arabia, which he had done throughout qualification. The fact that they had qualified was enough for the SFF to relieve him of his duties. It was probably a mistake in the long run for them, because they've gone through two coaches since Edgardo Bauza, who's had three national team jobs last year and failed again with Saudi Arabia. And we're now on to Juan Antonio Pizzi, completely different approach to Van Marwijk, a much more attacking approach, possession-based. Doesn't really fit Saudi Arabia at the moment, but there are a couple of green shoots in the last couple of friendlies. The Italy game, where they only lost 2-1, it was looking like it was starting to come together for the team. Another kind of failed experiment from the FA was as soon as they qualified, they signed up with an agreement with La Liga to try and get some of their players over to Europe. Always been, as I mentioned earlier, been an issue for Middle Eastern players to play in Europe. This agreement was obviously to try and help them to get consistent football in a high quality league. Of the three players that went over there who are in the World Cup squad, only 58 minutes was of pitch time was accrued. So that's probably going to backfire. They could have been playing regular football with the clubs back in Saudi Arabia, continuing on their kind of the team unity and the whole underdog spirit that they'll have to achieve the World Cup. But instead, I think they were trying too hard to kind of get their players into high quality teams. But to be honest, the quality is obviously not there just at this moment.
Yeah, because I remember the Spain's Footballers Union, they were very upset about that agreement. And I know they were saying that, you know, I think they were saying the economic aspect was more important than the sporting one. And I think it's a shame, because there's a lot of talent in Saudi Arabia. I mean, you know, they've qualified for World Cups in the past. I think there was that fantastic goal in 94, which a lot of people seem to have forgotten. But yeah, I think it's a shame. It's a massive nation as well. And what about Iran? Because we know about Carlos Queiroz. I say we know about him. We know how many clubs he's managed, and he hasn't done too well there. He's got Jahanbakhsh, who was the top goal scorer in Eredivisie, with 21 goals for AZ Alkmaar. And I know Carlos Queiroz is very, I don't know, his tactics are very reactive. He likes to play reactive football, deep line defence, quick counter-attack. Do you give him a chance of getting any kind of luck from this group? Because Portugal and Spain, we know they're going to be the top two teams. Morocco, you know, got a fantastic team as well. Do you give Iran half a chance of at least getting third place?
Yeah, I'll try and be positive on one of the teams. Iran are by and far the best team in Asia. It was quite scary how bad some of the teams were in qualification, but Iran were solidly consistent. They went 18 unbeaten, including 12 clean sheets, which is Kiros's calling card, really. He's always kind of built Iran on a solid defence. At the last World Cup, they did pretty well, sort of the quality of players that they had, or attacking quality players that they had. A 0-0 draw against Nigeria. They lost 1-0 to Argentina. It was last minute. Messi won the goal. So they can compete defensively. And within the last cycle, the quality of attacking players playing for teams in Europe has exponentially grown. As you said, Jotun Bash has done fantastic with AZ Alkmaar, but you've also got Ansari Fard, who's starting to score with Olympiakos. Sadar Azmoun did pretty well with Rostov. I know he's been kind of struggling for game time in Rubin Kazan this year, but he'll be leading the line. I think the way that the group's fallen, the fact that you've got Morocco first, obviously that's a must-win match if you want any progression. But assuming they did win that game, they're going to be at least 2 points ahead of either Portugal or Spain. And I think as a psychological barrier, you're into the tournament one game in and you're looking at progression. I think it is a useful schedule that they've been given. And I wouldn't write them off at all, really. The whole hopes of Asia are really falling on Iran at the moment.
Their preparation has been great, though, because I understand they were going to play Greece in Istanbul, and then that game was cancelled. And then they were meant to play Kosovo, and then that was cancelled as well, wasn't it?
Yes, this is typical from the IFF, which is probably the worst football federation, even in Asia, which is a stretch, really. Obviously, the politics around Iran is well known, and for that they struggle to get quality friendlies, but even the friendlies that they do they do conspire to actually mess them up. So the Greek friendly, the suggestions that it was cancelled because Greece was sponsored by a beer company. The Kosovo friendly, which was organised at late notice to replace the Greece friendly, the IFF wanted it behind closed doors, Kosovo didn't. And it's one of those situations where none of this should be known. It should be sorted out at a federation level, but it's gone on for years. In a way, these players are used to it, the fans are used to it, Carlos Queiroz is used to it, and I think it brings the team together. There's been a lot of speech about how Iran are unfairly treated by the world, really, because of the politics. So kind of one snippet of news that's come out in the last couple of weeks was Nike have refused to sponsor any of the players in the camp because of Donald Trump's views on Iran. So it's these sort of things that kind of you're battling against, especially for a Middle Eastern side. So Iran have struggled for kind of friendlies and so forth. But I think generally the football on offer, there's a lot more optimism going on. You just hope that the players are prepared enough physically for the challenge ahead.
Fantastic. Well, Martin, one more thing before I let you go, mate. Out of all those the teams that we've mentioned, which one of them do you give a good chance of actually progressing pretty well in the competition?
Iran would have the best chance, apart from obviously, of course, the group is hamstringing them, so I'll still probably say that Portugal, Spain will be the top two. I think the best chance is between Russia and Saudi Arabia in that opening game. There won't be a lot of quality, but I think whoever wins that is going to be in pole position to join Uruguay in the knockouts. For the rest, I think it's going to be another long, hard struggle. I'm just happy if we get a win here or there, a bit better than 2014.
Fantastic. Well, guys, you better check out Martin because he's got some fantastic content. He's got his own blog, haven't you, Martin?
Yes, yep.
You also contribute to Sandals for Goalposts and Russian Football News.
Yes,
would you like to give our listeners your Twitter handle and any other ways they can contact you?
No, my Twitter is the best way. I'm at Plastic Pitch. And as I say, follow all the kind of content on Sandals for Goalposts, who are a brilliant kind of outlet for Asian and African football. And then Russian Football News, which will give you news past, obviously the hysteria around Russia and the media. They'll give you on-the-ground reports throughout the World Cup.
Fantastic. Well, Martin, thank you ever so much for your time, mate. Really appreciate it. Hope to have you back on the show sometime soon, especially during the World Cup, when hopefully we can review some games together.
No, that'll be great, Stel. Thank you for having me on.
Anytime, mate. Thank you very much. Well, guys, thank you very much for listening. It's been a fantastic show. Martin's been a fantastic guest. And you can follow us, obviously, on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. We have a Facebook group page. And we hope you enjoy the World Cup, because we will be. Until next time, take care.